Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Richard Osijo, a host on New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network, and this interview is being done in partnership with the Community and Urban Sociology section of the American Sociological Association and its academic journal, City and Community. Joining me today is Shauna Trinch and Edward Snyder, both of whom are associate professor of anthropology and colleagues of mine at John Jay College of Criminal Justice of the City University of New York. And they're going to talk to us today about their recent book, What the Signs Say, Language, Gentrification, and Placemaking in Brooklyn, about how public language can create place and how place is experienced through public texts like signage. Shauna and Edward, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us. It's really great to be here.
Thank you, Richard. It's a pleasure.
All right, great. So why don't you just start by telling us briefly about your own professional background, your prior work, and also as a married couple, how you decided to work on this project and write this book together.
I guess I'll start, ladies first, right? So I am a sociolinguist. I have my PhD in Hispanic linguistics, actually, from the University of Pittsburgh. And my first body of work was on Latinas' narratives of domestic violence in the sociolegal system. So I felt really fortunate to come to John Jay to be able to work at a school of justice, since my work was really oriented towards justice. And one of the things that was interesting to me in that body of work was that even at the narrative level, people had this need to standardize language. And institutions really wanted to give credit to this notion of like a well-formed narrative, got legal credibility, if you will. And I've kind of carried that through all of my work, this idea that there are other valuable ways of speaking that aren't necessarily institutional standards. And this project has a lot of that in there, so we can talk about that later. But I'll leave it there and let Ed introduce himself.
Well, thank you, Shauna. So I'm a political anthropologist, and I'm interested in power, identity, and social justice in general. I also got my PhD in cultural anthropology at the University of Pittsburgh, and that is where I met Shauna, and that's where we became a married couple. You know, we can talk about that later. I studied post-socialist societies in the area of environmental activism to start with my dissertation research in Slovakia, and then I moved from there into studying gender violence, policing, law, and eventually human trafficking in field sites in Kazakhstan and in Bosnia, among other sites in Eastern Europe. And my work generally has a common thread of looking at societies in transition, which actually brings, you know, me right up to the place where I live and work, and that is Brooklyn, New York. And I'll leave it at that.
Well, we got here. You also asked how we kind of came to work together on this project because we had never worked on a project before. We both had our different areas. And we moved to Brooklyn because Ed got a job at John Jay College in 2003. And I was able to take a leave from Florida State University where I worked at the time. And we had a baby. So I spent a lot of time strolling him around, trying to meet friends. and just realizing that I had never been in a place like Brooklyn, New York before. And there's this story that we tell in the book where Ed came home from class one day and he said, I told my students today that Brooklyn was the kind of place where people crammed as many words as possible on a storefront sign. And he said that they all laughed. And as a linguist, I was like, that's really interesting because I'd never seen signage like we saw in Brooklyn before. So then I started taking photographs of it and I couldn't stop. And I kind of dragged Ed in on the project and said, you know, there's something here we really should look at and you should bring your cultural anthropological lens to this. So that's kind of how we got started on this project and that early in 2018.
And to segue a little into that as well, I actually was doing work in Bosnia at the time and with small children at home, you know, that it seemed like maybe I shouldn't be doing a lot of this field research far away. And so a colleague of ours, Anru Lee, suggested that maybe the two of us could study a new project and do it in Brooklyn. And that was called the Atlantic Yards project. At the time, you know, we hadn't really thought about studying the city systematically itself, although we definitely noticed our surroundings and were thinking of where we lived as a field site, just as an experience. I've lived in many different urban settings, and I have to tell you that when I came to Brooklyn, I had never lived here before. And in fact, when we moved here, I had never visited the borough before that. And Richard, I know that you are actually from the area, and it's interesting. Maybe we can talk a little bit about our different perspectives and how we approach that, because I know you've done work here in the city as well. So just in terms of setting this up, when I made that comment to students, I was beginning to realize that I was a participant observer in a new field site. And Shauna's expertise in linguistics really got me thinking about how is language playing in a larger process, which we call gentrification. So at that point, our fieldwork was really informal. Isn't that right, Shauna? It was kind of
on the signage it was, right? On the signage it was. But then in 2010, we took our colleague Anru Lee's suggestion and we started to study the Barclay Center and that redevelopment by Four City Radnor that got introduced in 2003. We submitted an NSF that was awarded in 2010. And so then we really started studying that process. And then it was a matter of merging the two, using our ethnographic interviews from that study to inform what the sign said and what they meant, to inform our analysis of that. And so they kind of came together in a new iteration of what began as very different types of research.
And just to add a little bit about for your listeners, the Atlantic Yards project was touted as one of the largest redevelopment projects in New York City in its history. I don't believe that's true anymore. I believe Hudson Yards is the largest. But at the time, it was quite controversial and very much a symbol of how the borough was changing in a very rapid way. But it cited in between the neighborhoods of Fort Greene and Prospect Heights, also touching a little bit on the neighborhood of Park Slope, as well as Crown Heights, I think. And that area is actually quite small. And we started to really start to do a multi-method study of the changes in that area. And through that process, the signage that we were always seeing as something unique to Brooklyn was always coming out in our data. And we didn't necessarily know what it meant at the time, but we did know that it was significant and that it was something that you certainly noticed if you looked.
No, you couldn't really miss it.
Right. And you start the book with a couple of pretty specific examples, one of which is based at or really close to the Atlantic Yards project. So you talk about an entrepreneur opening up a bagel shop near downtown Brooklyn, and this is in 2007 when the Atlantic New Arts Project was still in the works. And he names it Arena Bagels and Bialys, and he's anticipating what was going to be the basketball arena, which everybody perceived as the center of this project. Eventually, it was named the Barclays Center. And as you said, this was a very controversial project with local residents protesting its scale, its use of public funds, the idea of government overreach into private property. And they didn't even like this entrepreneur naming his bagel shop to recognize the future arena. And so he eventually changes it to Area Bagels and Bialys. And then in the other example, in the introduction, about a decade later, a woman opens up an upscale restaurant called Summerhill without clear signage in Crown Heights, a neighborhood not too far from where the Atlantic Arts Project was being developed, Crown Heights being a gentrifying, low-income, majority Black neighborhood. And she opens it in a space that still had bullet holes in one of its walls. And she didn't just keep the holes there. She promoted them in interviews and on social media, perhaps as some kind of symbol of authenticity of the space or the neighborhood or whatever. And local residents, people who have very different associations with gun violence, protested the restaurant and its use of the holes out of anger. And eventually she covers them up. Now, these are really vivid examples, both from different parts of Brooklyn undergoing some related changes. We'll come back to them in greater detail a little later on, but tell us what the importance of signs are, just in general, for understanding these varieties of urban change.
So I love these two examples in the context of this massive redevelopment project, because it really shows all of the different players, and ourselves included. We moved here in 2003, kind of, not at the beginning by any stretch of the imagination of the gentrification process of Brooklyn, which, of course, began long before that, a decade and a half at least, maybe two decades before that. But there were big and small moves, and think about it. We have a paper that we haven't published yet, but where we talk about big and small moves in the gentrification process and in the process of placemaking. And people, think that signage maybe is not important or insignificant, but the signage is one of those really visible and tangible signs of gentrification, and of what a place is becoming, or in the pre-gentrification setting, it is of what a place is. And they're not just commercial spaces, right? We had a discussion with Elizabeth Chin, who is an anthropologist. And she, when we were telling her about this, she said that these are, storefronts are profoundly political spaces. And that was something that that we started to think about when we started to operationalize what indeed they were saying and how they were making place.
And so when we started to really systematically gather photographs of signage, and it was something that Shauna was doing kind of constantly in her going around and just living life, but also as a researcher, and then as we were doing the Atlantic Yards ethnography and interviews with people, no matter where we would go, we would record storefronts. And just as my original joke to students revealed something, I believe, emically important. In other words, from that native's point of view, they understood that what I was commenting on was a type of signage that was normal, yet not really like other types of signage. And so when we looked at the data, we started to realize that there were essentially two sign types. And those types each represented a different Brooklyn. And the first one we called old school, because when we asked the students, hey, well, what are you talking about? What kind of sign is that with a lot of words crammed on it? They themselves kind of named it and referred to it as such. And they used the term old school kind of in all of its sociological meanings, in terms of referring to the past, but also having a respect for the past, like an origin with some kind of significance. And the other type of sign, we didn't really know what to call it, because when we first started to look at the what was being represented linguistically and semiotically, we were a little bit at a loss as to what it was. But in a nutshell, these new signs that we were seeing practically had no text on them at all. And in the book, we show a few examples of those sign types. And also in the old school example, some signs had as many as, 36 to 40, 60 words on them. And it was pretty standard. However, when we took a deeper dive as scholars, and Shauna can say a little bit more about this in terms of a linguistic approach, we started to see other features about each sign type. And that, that kind of really started us thinking about the meaning of how text is read, how it's engaged with. Did people notice? Were they seeing what we were seeing? And so, we started out with a kind of an unknown experience that we felt was significant, but then when you put the data together, we definitely see something very clear. So I don't know, maybe Shauna, would you like to run through the features of each type of sign?
Well, first I wanted to just say that, that these two examples of Summerhill and Arena Area Bagels really get at this idea that people do care what the signs say, right? So there's like two different things that we talk about in the book. One is that people think that signs are mundane and unimportant. And then there's these two examples where people, protested. I mean, they actually took these store owners to task because it was important. The way that they were making place, the way that they were connecting themselves to place was important to the community. And so that's one of the reasons why we start out with those two, because they really do illustrate that, while we all go about our daily life and walking through the city, we do notice and we do get a sense of what meanings are being created for us. So I don't know if that answered your question, Richard.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're getting at some of the theory involved here. This idea of the linguistic landscape of places, I think, is quite powerful. You have a great quote on page 16, where you say, signs communicate not only what is inside for sale, but also who is perceived to be outside. So I was wondering if you can go a bit more into the sociolinguistic aspects of the book about the framework and the idea of what linguistic landscapes are and what are the linguistic processes that we use to try to make sense of these linguistic landscapes, specifically through signs.
Sure. So, we start with this idea of indexicality, which was really well developed by Michael Silverstein, who just passed away last year. But he left a huge mark on the field of linguistic anthropology, where he talks about how words are always intertextual and they're always pointing to different populations and to different people. And we also use Michael Warner and his theory, where he talks about like every text picks out its public, right? So texts are not created in vacuums. They are never without histories. They're never without precedents. And they don't come without some connection to other texts. And that's just how we make sense of the world and of life. And so in the linguistic landscape, as Ed was talking about, there are these two different types of signage. There's this old school signage, which seems when we do the analysis and we say, well, what is actually on this sign and what are they indexing? What are they pointing to? In this old school signage, we see that they're pointing to everyone. Everyone is included. Multiple languages are included. Multiple dialects are included. Lists of every possible thing that you could want in the store is often included. And sometimes two of kind of the same category. So, you'll get bagels and buns, right? So it's not just for the people who want bagels, but also for the people who might want buns. you get this symbiosis of cultures. You'll get things like halal Chinese kitchen. You'll get Chinese and Tex-Mex, Spanish and American food, right? Like, so all of this is like kind of saying that in old school Brooklyn, that old school Brooklyn is a multiracial, multi-ethnic place where there is a space for everyone. And the new signage was really interesting because it always kind of left you guessing about everything, guessing what was in the store, guessing what kind of food they might be serving or what products they had. It was never, but there was always something a little playful, unclear. And then when you started unpacking the meanings of sometimes these like one words, right? So they were textually very sparse, but potentially deep in meaning, right? Many, many meanings, many layers in these words. And then we started thinking about how that was an intertextual reading process, right? Where you're supposed to be connecting this text to a whole bunch of other texts. And what were those texts? Well, often they were like history or art or literature, things that, you know, often, and not often, but may require college degrees to be able to decipher and understand. And so that was a different type of indexing, a different type of pointing that was seemed as if it were for a more exclusive community. So those were kind of the linguistic frames that we started working with, the theory, to help us decipher what the signs were really saying.
Just to jump in, I just want to give a couple of examples to support what Sean is saying, because an old school sign will have on it something like Third Avenue Deli, and a new school sign will have maybe one word that is a little cryptic and you're not really sure. And I'll just give you an example, the word habit. So you go from this very local placed signage that often either has a name, a person's name, a name of a business that in fact indicates what they are selling very clearly, you know, what kind of shop it is. And then you have almost no indication of what's in the store. We started to put together systematically all of the features that were represented in some combination in these two sign types. And when you go through the data, we have about 2,000, maybe 2,500 at this point in our data set of storefronts. We see that they have a very consistent indicator of the types of characteristics that fall into each one. So just very briefly, old school is not simply about numbers of words on a sign, but it's about really large lettering, very explicit references, clear indications of what's in the store, long lists, repetition of those words, which if you go down Fourth Avenue in Brooklyn and you pick out any given old school shop sign, you'll see sometimes repeated once, twice, three times on the same storefront information that is included on the original shop sign. Old school also has what we call ancillary signage. And for those of you who have been to Brooklyn or other parts of New York or any major city, you might see an ATM sign. And it's put outside of a store, not necessarily a deli or a grocery store, but maybe some other type of business. And they'll have underneath it a smaller sign that says $10 bills. And then finally, what we see in old school is, getting back to the theory side of it, references that are indicating a race, a class, a religion. And these are very explicit references, and we didn't exactly know how to interpret what these references were from a sociological, cultural perspective, until we drew on the work of John Jackson, who helped us operationalize the difference between the idea of authenticity and what he calls sincerity. And just very briefly, the idea of authentic was what we were thinking about in terms of old school Brooklyn signage. You might say that Arena Bagels was the authentic first, you know, type of sign. But authenticity is something that anthropologists actually really struggle with, and linguists as well, because it implies, as John Jackson tells us, that there's some kind of overarching authority that provides the authentic. In other words, anything that is claiming authenticity is kind of objectified and requires some confirmation, a certification, if you will. John Jackson, on the other hand, notes that a sincere, explicit expression of some characteristic or quality is really a subjective act, and it's made between subjects that have an equity, or that theoretically could have an equity. And so when we saw shop signs that had explicit references to religion, to race, and to class, we realized that these were very sincere assertions that were being done publicly on the street. The reason why I bring that up is because it's very different from what we see in the what we're calling new school signage, which are representations of gentrifying storefronts, usually upscale places of business that have appeared recently. And on those very minimalist storefronts, there are other types of features that are clearly systematic. Like, as Shauna mentioned, there's some playfulness, there's some mystery about them. And we started to realize that there was so much wordplay going on these very like one or two or three word shops, that there was a little bit more happening than simply just a intellectual game. Or an indication of upscaleness. So I'm going to leave it at that, because that really takes us to where we started to think about what old school signage meant generally as a collective. And maybe I'll let Shauna talk about that, about the capitalism without distinction.
So, yeah, I mean, and people have debated that maybe that's not the right term, capitalism. We're not talking about like ownership of huge means of production. But what we see in this marketplace, in the old school Brooklyn marketplace, is this idea that, and I kind of, you know, I heard these sayings when I was growing up, my money is as green as everybody else's. And I never understood them to be racialized terms. Until I started studying Brooklyn. And capitalism without distinction is a place where everybody is supposed to be able to buy and sell. And at least that's what the signs say. And, you know, there has also been some question about whether we are suggesting that Brooklyn was some kind of utopia. And certainly we're not suggesting that. We're aware of the history of Brooklyn and some of the difficulties that, you know, strife, racial strife, class strife that people have had in the past and continue to. But the signs say something different, right? The signs say that there is a place for everybody in this marketplace. And that if you want to buy something, it doesn't matter who you are, we'll find you something to sell. There is this kind of like, you know, as Ed says, there's all this reiteration. Sometimes the same things are said in different ways on the signs. So there's almost this make no mistake, you're welcome here. Your money is welcome here. This is a place where it doesn't matter who you are. It just matters that you were doing business. And that seemed to just really come through in the old school signage. And that's why we kind of started talking about capitalism without distinction, this kind of idealized marketplace where you didn't have to be any particular type of person. In comparison then to the new school signage, and getting back to this idea about authenticity and sincerity, right? And the differences between those two words. When we started thinking about these old school signs as holding space for different types of people, where like the signs literally say, we do African-American hair, We have Islamic hijabs. We are a Catholic store, so come and get your statues here. Whatever the case, there's always this reference to people and their sincere identity constructions, if you will. Whereas the new signs had a lot of irony in them, it was shocking when we started looking at how groups that were not white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, cisgender males were being used as kind of the joke on the sign, if you will, in this ironic way. And I think that's what really helped us understand the difference between sincerity and authenticity, right? Being really sincere about who we are and what we're doing here, as opposed to using other cultural categories or organizing principles in an ironic and kind of, funny, meant to be funny way, which of course wasn't really funny and isn't funny. And then we started asking people what they thought about this usage of certain types of groups. And people definitely felt that it was exclusionary, that it was objectifying. So the signs started saying way more than we bargained for, I think, when we really started doing a deep analysis and then started asking our informants in the field what they thought about different types of these two different types of signage.
Yeah. So to build a bit from this last point you made about being more exclusive, in the third chapter, I believe you get into this topic of the reproduction of social stratification in the new signage, especially considering how connected new signage has been playing in gentrification and in placemaking within Brooklyn. This chapter, though, especially revolves around gender, specifically motherhood and its intersection with race and social class. You say that while many women are changing the landscape in gentrifying neighborhoods through stores and signage that upend conventional understandings of gender and motherhood and value, they're not necessarily being inclusive across lines of race or social class. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the new Brooklyn mothers and the role that they're playing here through signage in gentrification and, by extension, social stratification.
Yeah. So, in a lot of the urban studies literature, the urban centers are written about with this really kind of masculinist meanings attached to them. People also in narratives that we acquired in our research suggested, that women were out of place in urban centers. White women were out of place in urban centers. And then I did come here as a white woman who was a professor. And so I had an identity, I guess, as a gentrifier, an older one, I would add. But I felt that living in Brooklyn, New York with an infant was a unique experience. I had friends all over the world who did not have this experience of motherhood that I was having, where, 10 or 15 women would meet in the park on a random Thursday, with our infants. And this kind of continued through our children's schooling. And I saw that women that I associated with or that I was studying, who were kind of my social demographic, college educated or even advanced degrees, people with advanced degrees, were going into all of these different settings in the urban sphere, whether it be the schools or the supermarkets, the streets, and saying things need to change around here. Right. They wanted a higher, better quality of foods in the way of organic food. They wanted schools to be more inclusive of them. They wanted to have more of a say in their children's education. And they definitely wanted the streets of Brooklyn in terms of cars. I think that was the biggest thing that we were working with, pedestrian safety was woefully lacking in Brooklyn. And so in those three areas, we saw women trying to make a change in the city. And then on the storefronts, we also saw them being really bold from stores like Boing Boing, for example, which you know, we talk about in the book, puts the cervix right on the sign, right? Puts cervical caps right on the sign. However you want to interpret these kind of coy, cryptic, playful language. And then at the same time, we started looking at the press and found that, wow, people did not like women taking these, making these claims to urban space, trying to change urban space. And so this chapter is kind of about that. It's about the problematics of being mothers and coming into the city and I guess in some ways trying to tell everybody what to do. And then feeling the backlash, right? Feeling the backlash from different institutions, from the press about that and being told, you know, hold up. So that chapter is about that. And then on the signs, you know, we the one sign that we really talk about a lot in this chapter is this sign called Baby Mama, which is racialized and racist. And so when we in the context of this story of Brooklyn motherhood, right, people with good intentions who did want to see benefits for everybody, not just for their own children, but for all of the children that were in the school, for all of the pedestrians who walked on the street. It was difficult to try to make these changes and also suffer the backlash. And so then that's how we came to this kind of understanding of what Eleanor Oakes calls indirect indexicality, where Baby Mama was kind of being used as cover to say, well, don't take us that seriously. We're not really that threatening. And that's how we kind of came up with that analysis of that storefront. Like, why use this term that in the community, in the African-American community, is a contentious term and is not a term for everybody to use in that community. And then for, you know, white gentrifiers to throw it up on a sign without regard for what it means in the Black community needed some explaining, right? Needed some explaining. And I think that the theory really points to this idea, you know, it comes from Jane Hill and other people who study African-American, the appropriation of African-American English, that people use these terms to try to look cool, to try to look more at ease than they might be. So that chapter is kind of complicated, and it is it was an interesting chapter for us to write about. I don't know if you have anything to say about that, Ed.
I will say that I think thinking about when other informants of ours found out that there was a store called Baby Mama in a neighborhood in Brooklyn, they were rather shocked, and one informant actually grimaced. And just seeing someone's emotional reaction to having a word that has significance in your cultural perspective out there up on a sign, which is pretty much available 24/7, it's an interesting lens to kind of see. And we bring it then back around to the real significance of that ironic and playful and in many ways, dismissive and oppressive in terms of a linguistic regime that is publicly out there in terms of shop signs. We can talk a little bit more about those dynamics that we do cover in later chapters. But the Baby Mama example, which we juxtaposed with a store called Boing Boing, shows you a little bit of the dynamics of the gentrification process in Brooklyn and how new people came in with a sensibility of being political and challenging mores and challenging norms. from a gendered perspective, and then kind of seeing how it goes all the way to being somewhat offensive to some communities. And of course, the intersectionality issues of it link up with Oakes's indexicality and indirect indexicality operating of the terms itself. So the shop has a lot more function than simply just bringing people to attract them to the gentrification process. And it is actually an assertion of dominance. So then it becomes very puzzling to figure out how the role of women in that dominant position in a community kind of gets played out. I wanted to add, Shauna, that the backlash, just to give readers some example, you know, there was a lot of things written about women who were simply trying to raise their children without the benefit of family kin networks. And any anthropologist would tell you that traditionally women have had a lot of kin support in raising children, and even in modern and in postmodern settings. But here in Brooklyn, there are a lot of women who do not have those supports. They are juggling professional identities. And that transformation was so significant that some of the census work that we did to support a lot of the analysis in the book, when it came to women who were educated and who were 25 years and older, in looking at census tract data for the borough, we discovered that the number of women who had college degrees or higher from the year 2000 to 2016 practically doubled. And you're talking about like 170,000 people, residents. So the demographics of what was going on, and then what you see in terms of signage and you know, kind of, you know, having a cover for a huge transformation of culture, especially at the level of white gentrifiers, was very interesting. And that was a tough chapter to write, because we were really trying to figure out exactly how this signage kind of operated, and not necessarily in a malicious way, but clearly in a way that had some political expression on multiple levels.
Yeah, thank you. It's a very nuanced chapter that you have there. So moving along, the next chapter then, chapter 4, puts these more independent, I guess, more mom and pop shop forms of signage of gentrifying neighborhoods undergoing a transition, against more corporate forms of placemaking, which create these competing semiotics in the landscape over what Brooklyn is and what it is becoming. And this chapter really uses the Atlantic Yards Project, which we mentioned earlier, as its main example. Now, the mix of reactions to this and to other large-scale development in Brooklyn through signage and landscape interpretation and misinterpretation is really fascinating. What are some of the conflicts that emerge when these bottom-up and top-down messages converge and compete with one another in urban space?
Yeah, I'll jump in here. I think that story about corporate signage, which we are only now touching upon, is really interesting to bring up, and then to just look at it analytically and say, well, when you see a corporate sign, what is it that you see? Applying our linguistic approach and our cultural approach, it's a placelessness, and it's there's a kind of an odd democracy about it. In terms of its expression, in terms of what it's telling you, it's the same for everybody when they see the sign or they see a logo. In many ways, it's instantly recognizable. So when we started to really look at the Atlantic Yards Project and its saga, circling back into the field research that we did, with our understanding now of this idea of placemaking, you see how important the corporate development and how extensive that development process is. One informant actually described it as just a express train going through your neighborhood. And some residents, many people of color, actually felt it was important to get on that train and to support that project. And we opened that chapter with a vignette from a housing activist, pretty well-known person named Bertha Lewis. She was president of ACORN for some time, and now she is the president of the Black Institute here in New York City. Her story is fascinating because it shows you the confusion that people have in reading signage and their expectations of the future and of the society and the government in which they live. And one of the things that's pretty clear about corporate signage is there's no confusion when it comes to displacing the local in any form. And when we started to piece together the different factions of the Atlantic Yards battle, there was an interesting set of fault lines where a lot of gentrifiers were very much against this project, and a lot of long-term locals who were being displaced by gentrifiers were somewhat in support of that project. So in terms of different elements and different aspects to understanding the future of the borough, it became pretty clear that both old school and new school businesses were ultimately going to be replaced by corporate America and their encroachment into the area. How those individual establishments battled it or how they interpreted it was a little bit more complicated. And also how individuals themselves positioned their experience of change in a neighborhood was also very interesting. And we bring some of that out in that chapter as well. One thing that looking at the Atlantic Yards area and then going historically and trying to figure out what was going on in those neighborhoods led me to the New York City Department of Records, which has a vast treasure trove of tax photos from the 1980s and also from the 1940s. And it wasn't that easy to actually work and manipulate, but and the quality of the photos are not all that great, interestingly, as a researcher. But the sheer coverage of the city visually is incredible, and it's a 40-year difference. And then with our photo record from the 2000s, you could actually see three different time periods of the same street address, you know, a block, et cetera. And so I started to systematically piece together what a streetscape looked like from like 1970, at a time when there was a lot of issues and problems in a divested city, a city that was experiencing disinvestment and white flight and transformation. And interviewing people in the neighborhood who had gentrified those spaces about their original experience with that time period was very interesting, because the data that I was seeing in the photographs was not the same as what they were telling me their experience was of the past. So then, you know, you start to go even further into the past and ask, well, what did signs look like in other places in the 19th century? What is the relationship between public text and urban space as a history? And this chapter really didn't go too much far into that question, but even starting with the Atlantic Yards process, we ended up actually looking at the history of signage in an American city.
Right, thank you. And then finally, the chapter 5, the last data chapter that you have, returns to Summerhill, the Crown Heights restaurant with the bullet holes. And here you use this example of a white owner defending her decision to keep a racially insensitive aesthetic feature in the face of protest from residents in this majority Black gentrifying neighborhood that has experienced much strife and pain in recent years, to discuss the power of signage and language to reproduce white privilege and racial hierarchies in these communities of color. So please walk us through the details of this case and how you came to these findings.
So this chapter is also, you know, pretty nuanced, I think, in that we were put in touch with this informant, Justine Stevens, who kind of led the protest against Summerhill. And the Summerhill shop in Crown Heights opened and suggested in their advertisements that they had a wall with bullet holes. The bullet holes were not bullet holes. The holes were not bullet holes, actually. They were, I don't know, they came from a cooler that had been pulled out of the plaster. Isn't that right, Ed? I think that's what it was.
They were bolt holes from shelving.
Yes, something like that. And so the owner tried to capitalize on this idea of like urban, you know, what her preconceived notion of what it meant to be urban and to create this kind of feeling of thrill, maybe through the bullet holes and the fake bullet holes. And so she suggested in her advertisements that this was a thing. And so a colleague of ours brought us a news clipping about it. And then we reached out to Justine Stevens, who was our key informant here. And for me, it was really interesting to let her tell us what theory and what data mattered here. And I think, you know, it was a great exercise in white privilege for me to look at the original, Peggy McIntosh's descriptions of white privilege and just overlay them right onto the case as Justine told us about it. And so that's really what this chapter is about. And it you know, I don't know how many of those, what are there? She has 47 some or something different points that people enact on white privilege. And I don't know how many of them we actually found in this chapter, 20 or so. But it was just very interesting to see how no matter how many times she was told, the store owner, and no matter how many ways she was told, she still wanted to do what she wanted to do. And so what was so illuminating to us is this idea that at least this community, you know, at least Justine Stevens, from what she and the people that she was with were saying was, look, we get that you're going to get it wrong and that you haven't experienced gun violence the way that this community has. But now that we tell you about it, you should do something to change it. And that was what was really fascinating, the reluctance to change it. I don't know if you wanted to add something there, Ed.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it was not only a reluctance, but kind of a doubling down on you know, refusing to concede, not accepting any sort of blame. And when we as social scientists kind of look at the data, and I know Shauna did a lot of work in assessing the meeting in which and the dialogue in which you could actually go through the transcript and see what was being said. The McIntosh items in the backpack have a lot to do with communication and public behavior. And we were seeing how this was being played out by the shop owner in her intransigence and in her, you know, resistance to concede even an inch or to take any responsibility for having done something that was interpreted as offensive. The case was something that came to us late in our research. And yet, as we started to see what was happening there, we realized how significant it was, because Summerhill, this bar and restaurant that opened up, was really only a few blocks. I mean, from a Brooklyn perspective, a few blocks. I mean, maybe a mile or two away from the actual arena bagels that Richard, you noted starts out our book on the same street. And what we were seeing also in the case of Summerhill is that the process of gentrification pushed on by corporate redevelopment with the Atlantic Yards was moving very steadily and actually very quickly, like right before our eyes during the process of doing research, moving from the west to east in Brooklyn. And it's a very clear pattern that you can see definitely reflected in shop signs.
Right. Thank you. So I was wondering if you just tell us quickly what the writing process was like for you when it came time to actually write the book. How did you manage that?
Do you want to start, Shauna?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a messy process.
We don't talk anymore.
No. We actually worked really well together. I really enjoyed writing this book with Ed. And you know, the best way to get to know a place I've always found is through ethnography. And so when we moved here, I kept saying to myself, oh, how can I start to feel at home, like, in this place that is so different and so, you know, like nothing I'd ever been in before. And it was massive. And I started remembering other places where I'd done ethnography. And I was like, yeah, I started to feel at home there. So let's do some ethnography. So convincing Ed to do it was the first part of the process. And then when we started writing, I mean, there were so many different ways that we approached it. But one always stands out to me. This is the story that I always tell, is that I have this process and where I just put it all on a page and then I kind of hand it off and Ed would be like, oh my gosh, this is a mess. What is this? But then he would take it and he would spend a couple of days with it and he would make it look brilliant. And then he'd give it back to me and then I would, you know, work further with it and do more analysis. So we really had this kind of, you know, that's how I think about the work that I originated. Of course, there was work that he originated too, but in work that I originated, I would just like give it, just, you know, sit for hours and write and write and write and then hand it off to him and he would massage it and put it into form. And we have a small place where we live and I would try to make myself even smaller because I didn't want him to see me. I didn't want to have to hear him say like, what is this mess? So I would try to be really like small as I walked by him.
Yeah, and if I can just jump in there, the Shauna's writing process is all about thoroughness and great description, and that's clear, and like every detail, and you know she's a linguist at heart in her process, although much of her work is actually very, you know, anthropological in approach, but if she didn't have the editor, then the book would have been about 1,000 pages long. And I don't think anybody wants to read that. But my personal story about the process is more finding the data to fit the cases and to find the connections in a multi-method way was really challenging and enlightening in this project for me. We would do interviews with people in 2010, I think, Shauna, and we would come back 5 years later and see the significant line in that interview, which we didn't see at the beginning. And when you do read it, after you've done other field work and after you've experienced other things and talked to other people, then you see how important a statement is, an utterance by an informant. And that was really interesting. And then the other thing that was really challenging, I think, was working with the census, which I found going back to the 70s, I was at some version of the New York Public Library behind the Graduate Center. And that was the only place I could find the 1970s data on CD-ROM. And I mean, what an experience to like be putting these discs in and opening files up that, you know, now when we look at the 2000 census, the 2010, it's American Fact Finder, and these different programs are much easier to deal with. So it was a great experience, but it also was very, very challenging methodologically.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it was a very big undertaking that you took on. So Shauna and Ed, you've been very generous with your time, but before we finish, I was wondering if you could just tell us a bit about what you'll be doing to promote the book coming up, and tell us a little bit about what you've been working on since it came out, and anything new in the pipeline on the horizon.
On February 23rd, we're going to be at the Center for Brooklyn History with a star-studded cast. We will be there with What the Signs Say, and we'll be there with the founders of Black-Owned Brooklyn, Tayo and Cynthia Giwa, and also Peter Robinson, who is an architect and on the board of Black Space. So we'll be talking about Brooklyn and What the Signs Say on the 23rd of February. On March 25th, we'll be back at the Center for Brooklyn History, and we'll be there with Neil Goldberg, who is an artist, with Hank Willis Thomas, who is also an artist, and Jeremiah Moss, who wrote Vanishing New York, and we'll be there with What the Signs Say. So we're really excited about these two programs that are coming up.
All right, great. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and thank you so much for this book. It's excellent work. I hope people get a chance to read it like I have. So thank you so much for joining us and talking a little bit about it.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Richard. And thanks for your really generous and wonderfully constructed questions and the close read that you did. It's really exciting to talk to you.
Yes. Thank you, Richard, so much. I'm a big fan of your own work, and see a lot of similar themes and subjects at play in your research. So thank you so much for this opportunity.
All right. Thank you. Take care.